Well, you can turn in your Bibles to Luke 14, which is where we're going to be today. And let me give us a little bit of context. Well, first off, let's be reminded that as Jesus is down here on earth, he's here for a couple different reasons. The first is he's here to do a work in men's hearts, a work of setting them free, of making them whole. He's also here to cast vision, something called the gospel or the good news, which is directly connected to this idea of kingdom, that Jesus has come down to speak of a kingdom larger than this world, that this world operates under a set of rules that ultimately in the end is too small and leads to destruction. And he's come to reveal the fact that there is this greater kingdom that envelops. It's not like you have kingdom A over here and kingdom B over here, but you have kingdom A here, and then kingdom B is this larger perspective of something greater that God is doing. But what happens if you live your life in accordance to this second kingdom? It's so radically different that it, in the end, takes kingdom A and flips it on its head. It turns it upside down, which is why Jesus' teachings is like always like creating friction, that it confronts system A as he casts vision for system B, that the way that this world operates is one that eventually leads to division, to arrogance, to disconnection from God. And so as he's casting vision, it comes with conviction. And honestly, one of the keys, I think, to the spiritual life, and this is difficult, but it's learning to develop an appreciation and an appetite even for conviction. That the way that that feels, at first, I think all of us would admit when we feel conviction, it creates defensiveness, we put up walls, we want to hold that at arm's length. But one of the keys to growing in the spiritual life is when conviction comes, we see it as an invitation. We allow it to come in and do deeper work. That God is coming in and healing our hearts, but the way that he points out where he's at work oftentimes has this texture of, ooh, right. And instead of avoiding that or shutting that off in some closet over here, instead with courage we step in and take a good, honest look at what the truth is revealing. Now the context of Luke 14, Mark gave a great sermon last week talking about the fact that this is happening at a banquet. I've heard it said that Luke's gospel, someone summarized it as basically is eating good food with bad people. Jesus is always eating through Luke. It's like banquet after banquet after banquet where, you know, as they would gather for these Sabbath meals, they would do it in such a way that they would invite people together. And there's kind of a hierarchy, as it turns out, of these different banquets that happen. And just like today, every once in a while, an event like this happens where it's the place to be. And the context of this banquet is it's in one of the religious leaders, not just a Pharisee, but a member of the Sanhedrin. And so you could imagine everybody showing up. This, they might as well be like that backdrop where everybody gets their picture taken walking in, right? It's kind of like if you imagine Vanity Fair or something like that. It's not just, you know, who's hosting the party, but who's there. And so Kanye and Kim are there and different people. And so it's kind of the place to be. And so what happens is, you know, in response to this, is everybody starts positioning themselves, posturing where they're going to sit. Are they, you know, at which table and which seat? And this sort of dynamic is one that shouldn't surprise us because I think it is so common to us today, this way of operating that's kind of an unspoken social set of significance or value. There's an essay called The Inner Ring that was written by C.S. Lewis, where he quotes War and Peace at the beginning. And I want to read this little excerpt. Can you bear with me? So a little Russian literature for us today. But it's talking about this, I'm going to butcher the name, Boris Dobretsky, I think is how you pronounce it. But it's Boris is in the military, and he's arriving in a new position of command. And when he goes to speak with this character, Prince Andre, there's a general there having a conversation, and this general is going to get put on hold. Okay, it says when Boris entered the room, Prince Andre was listening to an old general wearing his decorations, who was reporting something to Prince Andre with an expression of soldierly servility on his purple face. "All right, please wait," he said to the general, speaking in Russian with the French accent which he used when he spoke with contempt. The moment he noticed Boris, he stopped listening to the general, who trotted imploringly along after him and begged to be heard, while Prince Andre turned to Boris with a cheerful smile and a nod of the head. Boris now clearly understood what he had already guessed, that side by side with the system of discipline and subordination which were laid down in the army regulations, there existed a different and more real system. The system which compelled a tightly laced general with a purple face to wait respectfully for his turn, while a mere captain like Prince Andre chatted with a mere second lieutenant like Boris. Boris decided at once that he would be guided not by the official system, but by this other unwritten system. And I like how in here Tolstoy's talking about this unwritten system, I think even unspoken system, that this is something that we don't often speak about, but a dynamic that's kind of always going on. I remember unfairly doing this to a bunch of students in the youth group way back when I was the youth pastor, asking a number of students to stand up and then asking the group, okay, what I want you to do is in your head place them in order of coolness. And then second question, where do you fit in? Right? And there's this awkwardness, right, in the sort of self-awareness, but you go, you already did this when you walked in, whether or not you know it, right? It happens so subconsciously, and maybe not coolness later in life, although that still seems to matter, but value, significance, that you go, when we walk into any social situation, we're like placing ourselves, right? Who goes where? Where do I fit? And this thing, it's, if you find yourself at the top end, it's powerful. I remember this one time. I have a friend who, in the end, he wrote a book that made him famous, and he was speaking at a campus close by where I knew the person hosting this event, so I was invited to this event, and I was sitting with my friend, and then he and I like kind of snuck out at lunch and grabbed a bite to eat, came back for the later things, but my friend that was hosting the event said, it's so interesting, everybody kept coming up to me and asking who you were, right? Because I was sitting next to the important guy in the room, and everybody's like, okay, oh, who's he? And that feels pretty good, doesn't it? It's like there's like a sort of mystery to it, a sort of power that comes from this positioning. And if we're honest, there's a part of us, it's like Turkish delight. It's this thing that appeals to a deep part of our ego that loves that feeling of significance, that loves admiration, it loves to be adored. And it's not that honor is a bad thing, like we saw last week in Mark's message. Jesus is going to come in and he's going to say, listen, when you show up to a party, this is what you do. You take the seat at the lowest end. That's your rule. When you walk into a party, just go sit at the least important table. And then if somebody comes up and elevates you, great, right? You get bumped up to first class. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with sitting in a seat of honor. But this game, it's like Jesus is saying, stop. Don't play this game. As it turns out, that sort of significance only matters to this world's kingdom. And in a heavenly kingdom, that whole posturing is completely wrong. It's not only is it insignificant, it's backwards. Jesus is almost saying that the influence that you're looking for there, like it's not just meaningless, it kind of disrupts our way of thinking in such a way that it corrupts it. Where all of a sudden we are trying to posture ourselves as the greatest when in fact in God's kingdom it's the least. that the people that walk in their brokenness, the people that walk in from those outside rings, turns out they are the ones who matter most. Backing up just a touch into Mark's passage here, it says, "But when you are invited, go sit to the lowest place, that when your host comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." And I was thinking, you can game that system too. You could like noticeably go to the lowest table and look like you're really virtuous, right? Which is to miss the whole point. That whole thing, right? Jesus is really saying, stop playing. Why? Because when we try to create some sort of hybrid version of this, it turns our hearts into, Jesus is going to call it hypocrisy. We start trying to come up with a version of this where like it's got a little bit of humble, you know, God's kingdom, and then a little bit of strategy too. How do I like maximize these two worlds to work in my favor? Does that make sense? Are you following me? And the problem is it doesn't work. Maybe in the short term, it seems like there's gain. But on an internal level, where the whole problem is, on a heart level, it's drawing our affections either one way or the other. Jesus is going to say in a couple chapters, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve, in this case, both God and money. Money being the image or the symbol of that sort of power, currency, right? Doesn't have to simply be dollars in your wallet. It's that sort of independent power that we seek and that we crave. And as it turns out, it's the thing that God has come to heal. I wonder if he came today, if he'd talk about localism, right? At least to the surface, that's the same sort of game, right? How do you position according to that? How do you get known by the right people? How do you sit in that sort of posture, just enough aggressiveness? And what if Jesus was saying, hey, you know what? Just defer, give the waves to everybody else. And then, you know, you'd be like, there's not going to be any waves left for me, right? And so this is the thing. When you really think about what Jesus is offering, it's costly. Like, wait, what then am I supposed to do? I'm putting myself not just in a position of humility, but weakness, right? Vulnerability. And you realize this, what's being suggested, really challenges our faith. Do we believe that that's true? And most of us, if we're honest, would say, sort of. But when it really comes down to it, I love this from Donald Miller. He calls this game like a lifeboat, this idea of vying for significance. And he's referring to a different sort of values clarification exercise where, you know, the boat's sinking, you only have so many seats in the lifeboat, who gets a seat? Most of us are terrified that it wouldn't be us, right? So when we find ourselves in a seat in the lifeboat, we're not going to move. Donald Miller says this. He says, it seemed Jesus believed we should take every opportunity to fail in the lifeboat game. Not for the sake of failing, but because there wasn't anything to win in the first place. And I feel like this is what Jesus is trying to say. Like, this game you're playing, it's meaningless. In the end, it's like some little online virtual game that goes away when you turn the computer off. That any gains that you have, anything that takes place here, it doesn't last. What does is our hearts. And so if you want to be smart, that's what you're looking at. That's the thing that endures. And Jesus is saying, I've come to set that heart free. So Jesus, in this moment, he addresses the game, all this posturing, and then he turns to the host. And in verses 12 through 14, he says, then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back and you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed, although they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. All right, second sort of unpopular move of Jesus. He's saying, Okay, when you come to a party, sit in the worst seat. When you host a party, invite the people in the outer ring, not the inner ring. Find the people that don't get invited and invite them. Now, the party or the banquet, this is a parable. It's a symbol. He's really saying in life, you need to be looking for those left out and making sure they're included. Now, this is horrible advice for throwing a cool party. Right? This doesn't work. If you're going to throw a cool party, you need to make sure that you've got cool people at the center, and then everybody else will just show up because they want to fit in, right? It's going, nope. This is who you send the invitations to, the people that are left out. If you want to understand how to set this heart free, if you want to understand how to invest in the kingdom, if you want to understand how to live a life of deep meaning and value, you go find the people left out. And you make sure they're included. This can be awkward. I remember one time back in the day, we used to have this harvest festival at our church that we would do at Halloween. And we'd serve a meal beforehand. And somebody who was coming to the church just went down to the beach and invited all their homeless friends to come. And all of a sudden, there was like 20 homeless people that showed up for a free meal. Totally changed the party. Everybody starts going like, oh, is this safe? Right? I don't feel so comfortable all of a sudden. I mean, this is important. You think about what Jesus is suggesting, and it's awkward. And people start going, oh, is that a party that I really would want to be at? And Jesus is saying, when you're throwing these parties, when you're doing favors for people that can give you something in return. Don't do that. Go find the people that have nothing to give you in return. I like how James is later going to say, pure religion is to widows and to orphans. These people have no secret stash of money that they could turn around and give you later. Nothing with which to thank you properly. And God's saying, this is how you do kingdom work. That the return on the investment is something long-term, right? Looking way ahead. But at the same time, the work that it's doing right now in you, as you give up this idea of being repaid, as you give with no promise of a tax deduction, as you invest yourself in something by faith. Unsurprisingly, there's this like sort of awkward pause in our parable. That people are like sitting there going, oh, in that moment of conviction, right? As their hearts are sort of laid bare. And as they're sitting there, somebody exclaims this out. When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said, blessed is the man who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God. Right? He exclaims this platitude, which I think sometimes we do when we're uncomfortable in the silence, when there's crickets. He shouts out something positive like, won't this be wonderful when we're all at God's banquet? And Jesus turns to that guy and goes, wrong. Just because I like definitions, I was thinking this statement that he made, we would call this a bromide. It's a trite, unoriginal idea or remark typically intended to soothe or to placate. It's like saying, I just love you guys, right? I like kind of the bromide. I wonder if the etymology of the word has to do with bro. Like, oh man, I just love you guys. You know what? This is all going to be okay. We're like, why can't we just get along? Won't it be great when we're all at the banquet? But in verse 16, Jesus says to him, a man once gave a great banquet and invited many. And at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But when they all alike began to make excuses, the first said to him, I have bought a field and I must go out and see it. Please have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to examine them. please have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. This guy's saying, won't it be great when this all like sort of works out in the end and we all end up at the feast? And Jesus is saying, you know what? There's some of you out there when it comes time for the feast, you're not going to have an excuse and you're not going to show up because you're not going to like the party that I'm throwing. It's an interesting idea that I think we all sort of assume in the end that God is who we want when maybe we've lived our whole life saying, God, I actually don't want you in my life. I want to live by this other system. I want my heart to be free to pursue all these other things. And then in the end, at sort of a last minute, I'll shift. And Jesus is saying here, like with these excuses, well, first off, these are all people that sort of like clicked yes to the RSVP. They got the email. There's a party being thrown. And their first response was like, yep, I'll be there. But when it came down to it, when that final second invitation went out, all of a sudden they were too busy. And some people have said, are these good excuses? And I think, yes, yeah, so to speak. I think what Jesus is doing by way of this parable is kind of revealing a lack of this sort of disgenuine idea that they're saying, oh, no, you know what? Something came up. I got to take care of this plot of land that I just bought. I've got to look at these oxen that I purchased, or I just got married. These two invitations, right? Yes to the first, no to the second. First off, I want to point out for the introverts, don't feel judged by this parable. Because the introverts are the ones who always say, yeah, I'll be there, and then at the last minute don't show up, right? Does anybody know? Does anybody feel this? There's a shirt that says, sorry I'm late, I didn't want to come. Which is totally the introvert's card, like, dang. But I don't think that's what he's talking about. He's talking about a lack of sincerity. In fact, even some have thought that this may be a form of sabotage, where everybody says, yeah, we'll be there, we'll come, and at the last minute, none of the cool people show up. It's a way of undermining what this host is doing. And the fact is that this host has laid out a feast and worked hard over it and purchased all of it. And that there's a deep offense and there's a triteness in these cancellations. The first, oh, I just purchased this field I got to go look at tonight, right? And you go, what? Saying, I'm too busy. Sorry, wanted to be there, way too busy. Which is an excuse that probably we all use too much. In fact, it's almost like a badge of honor, isn't it? Like, how are you doing? Oh, I'm so busy. I'm so important. Yeah. My time is so valuable. I'm so busy. The second one, I just purchased these oxen, which is kind of odd, but I need to go look at them. I bought this thing. I don't really know what it is. I just purchased it on eBay. I bid on this thing, but now I got to go check it out. Somebody wrote, it's like saying, yeah, I can't come to the party because I just bought a used car without looking at it and I need to go inspect it. It's an odd sort of thing. It shows almost this obsession over material possessions. And the last one, I just got married. This guy doesn't even ask to be excused. And this is probably a reference to sex. That women wouldn't be invited. And he's going, I'd rather stay home with my bride. And hear what's being said here, that any of these things, inspecting a field or checking on oxen, you know, staying home with your spouse, these aren't offenses, but what they mask is something way deeper on a heart level, a lack of sincerity or a lack of self-obsession. They don't care about the host. They don't care about the banquet. They don't care about the celebration. In the end, they would prefer to just be left alone to do their own thing. And it's interesting to think about what these excuses mask and how we tend to trivialize that in our lives, these excuses. When in the end, I think Jesus is saying, look, those excuses can be fatal. You keep giving that excuse after that excuse, that disconnection, and pretty soon that's who you are. This is a person that just wants to be left alone. It's an interesting idea that C.S. Lewis plays with, is this idea that maybe hell is locked from inside. Right? That either, I've said this before, we say to God, thy will be done, or he says to us, thy will be done. And these people that are like, yeah, count me out. Sorry, can't make it. And he's going, that move of the heart is a dangerous one. 21. So the servant came and reported these things to the master, and then the master of the house became angry and said to his servant, go out quickly to the streets and lanes of the city, bring in the poor and crippled and blind and lame. And the servant said, sir, what you commanded has been done. There's still room. And the master said to the servant, go out to the highways and hedges, compel people to come in, that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those men who are invited shall taste my banquet. As we notice here, there's these two sort of circles. We have the inner ring, but Jesus is saying, go to the outer ring. Go to those that are sick. Go to those who are poor. And they're like, okay, they're all invited. Party's full. They're not full. There's still room. And he goes, oh, turns out there's another ring. And this is probably the ring of those that are hiding or ashamed. And Jesus is saying, make sure they know they belong. In fact, he says, compel them. Which probably means when you go out there and invite them, they're going to think they're being misused or taken advantage of. He's saying, compel them to come. This is the heart of God's kingdom. As he's saying, it reaches not just to that first ring, but to that second ring. This is where the good news goes. Now for that inner ring, it isn't good news. It's just inconvenience for those outer rings, the ones that are out there that feel like their lives have no value, no worth, that all they see in themselves is brokenness or even worse, shame. But the good news is for them. That the healing and the freedom and the grace is for them as well. And this is our mission as Jesus is speaking to us. He's going, not only is this a part of your healing, but you get to take part in this healing work. You get to be the ones that go out and extend this invitation to the very least. Mark called this last week downward mobility, and I love that phrase. He mentioned Henry Nouwen, who was somebody who went and ministered to somebody from Yale, Harvard background, went to work with a group of handicapped people as their chaplain towards the end of his life. And I love how he says in that story that pretty soon they didn't realize who had the infirmity and who didn't. They were just all broken and all in need of love. What he loved about the people that were disabled, especially the ones that had some sort of mental disability, is that they didn't care about any of his degrees. They didn't care about any of the things that he had done as far as his books that he had written or where he had spoke. They just cared whether or not he had a heart capable of loving them and could receive love. It's a window into God's kingdom there that Henry understood, like, is profound. That he saw his identity no longer in that inner ring, but in that outer one, or maybe in the one outside of that. When we take that lowest seat, we're reminded that we're nobody special. And that offends something in us that wants so desperately to be special. When we throw these parties that none of the cool people come to, we realize I'm just like everybody else. And that humility, as it turns out, is a way to freedom. On the other side of it, what we find is that who we are is uniquely valuable. The life God has for us is deeply meaningful. But that system, that world system, has to collapse first. There's a glory. I mentioned this quote the other day in one of my talks by Oliver Wendell Holmes, where he talks about simplicity and complexity. And he's going, I don't care about this simplicity, right? He says, I don't give a fig about this simplicity on this side of complexity, but the simplicity on the other side I'd give my life for. The glory, right, on this side of humility is all men striving. But the glory on the other side of it is something beautiful. It's that honor that that doesn't possess but holds it with an open hand. This is the good news that Jesus is holding out. He's saying, your destiny is a glorious one, and who you are is unique and incredibly valuable. But first, you've got to stop playing this game. Here's some questions. And then we're going to go to the Lord's table and feast. Number one, what practical way might you break yourself from playing the lifeboat game? How can you stop seeking the place of privilege and position? Not self-sabotage, but stepping off that treadmill. I mean, maybe it's a matter of like, answering the emails first that like are to the people of least influence, right? The things, the way that we triage this stuff and push down, all these are the inconsequential, and to go make sure that you have given your best to them and then answer the others later. Number two, what are my excuses I use for not showing up? How do I hide behind busyness? How do material things keep me from generosity? How do my desires hold me back from honoring others and my commitments? Gosh, that's one to sit with and catch yourself doing it. Catch these games that we play. Most of us, it's happening. It's so familiar that it's subconscious and we don't even see ourselves do it. And number three, how can you play host for the outer rings? How are we serving the least? I've said not so much church programs that we support, but actual time and relational investment. How do we do what Bryce is doing? He just goes, hey, here's a way to give back. I'm going to design this opportunity to give back to people in need in our community. But we do it because they matter so much. I think one of my proudest moments in ministry, this is not a pat yourself on the back, but a moment where I thought, oh, that's good fruit, is when we were doing meals with the Friendship Shelter. I was talking to Mark, who was in charge of it at that time, and he said, you can't hear what I'm going to say here. He said, we love when you guys do a meal here because you don't insist on doing like an altar call. You just serve them. And I thought, do you get what I'm saying there? What is at the heart of this is seeing the dignity of these others and responding to them in love, not a means to the end, not a way of pushing our thing on there, as a way of serving with a heart of genuine love. How important it is that we're engaging in that. Last little quote, and then we'll take communion. This from Henry. The great paradox which Scripture reveals to us is that real and total freedom is only found through downward mobility. The Word of God came down to us and lived among us as a slave. The divine way is indeed the downward way. Amen.